In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Yeah, it's time to talk movies. Pass the Popcorn, brought to you by the Bangor Drive-In and Bangor Mall Cinema 10. Alan Adams of The Main Edge with us. Hello there, Alan.
Well, hello there. How are you?
Doing very well, thanks. How's your Monday going?
Oh, it's going pretty well, all things considered. Doing all right.
Nice. And how was the weekend?
Oh, it was nice. Got out and about a little bit, you know, just sort of, you know, kicking around the house. Had a contractor over to do some estimating on some things. So, you know, we're in that place as far as the house is concerned, and generally taking it easy, trying to drink in the last few nice days where you can wander around outside before the cold really descends.
I'm a little bit confused here. Well, why would you, Alan Adams, need to call a contractor? You fixed a damn sink, man.
We're in the process of figuring out getting our roof reshingled.
You don't want to do that.
I'm not a ladder guy, I'm perfectly happy to write a check to someone who's willing to take on that particular chore on my behalf.
I don't blame you a bit for that. I'm not big on any kind of height, certainly not up on a roof on a windy fall day.
Yeah, right. Hey, listen, so I was listening to the conversation with Jeff Perlman. He's great, by the way.
Yes, he is.
You need me to tell you. I'm really bummed because my initial plan was to try to get into this coming week's edition a review of Three Ring Circus, but I'm not going to finish it in time, which is really a bummer. It's great. Like, it really is a great book from what I've got so far. I'm just not going to have time to get the review written in time to go to print, but it'll be up sometime this week, I think. He's so good at that sort of, you know, deep dive kind of situation. So I'm really looking forward to digging into it some more.
Yeah, and it's obviously the Shaq Kobe thing is great, but it's the little guys, the Cedric Ceballos of the world, the Derek Harpers, all these guys who are the Robert Ories, the role players that really bring the story to life, and the fact that so many of them tried like heck to have any kind of a relationship with Kobe, and he wanted no part of that at all.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I think that, you know, that's not going to really come as a surprise to anyone who paid attention to who Kobe was when he was, you know, when he was in the league. But, you know, having it sort of confirmed from the inside is really fascinating. And it's just a fascinating insight on a guy who, you don't necessarily get to be the best in the world at something without a single-minded devotion to the perfection of your craft. And, you know, that manifests itself in different ways with different dudes.
Well, exactly. I mean, you are that way, and yet you're still a fine fellow and good to hang around with because work-life balance. You're all about work-life balance, Al.
It's, you know, work-life balance, it's very important. It is absolutely key to a healthy life, I think, particularly in these days where the line between work and life starts to get a little blurry sometimes.
Oh, ain't that the truth? Yeah, that's why.
So it's just like, I feel for the folks who are tethered to Zoom meetings, whether it's, professional workers, educators, like the list goes on and on. Like, it's like, you know, you walk away from your work screen and then you sit down in front of your entertainment screen. And I could just see how that's, I admire the work that people are doing. I'm just going to put it like that.
There you go. Well, what did you see for movies this weekend, Alan?
Well, man, I don't know if we're going to have time to talk about all of them, because I got four.
Whoa.
I have a couple of video on demand offerings and one Netflix movie. The video on demand, the big one for the weekend was Antebellum, the movie starring Janelle Monáe. That was one of the theatrical releases that the big theatrical releases that got pushed from the spring and carries with it a pretty significant price tag, as some of the bigger name, the bigger ticket movies do. So $20 to rent Antebellum. So bear that in mind when we talk about it. A couple of other ones. A wonderful little intimate sort of family drama called Blackbird with a wonderful cast. And then a kind of weird, kind of bloody three-handed horror movie offering, actually co-written by a gentleman by the name of Jules Vincent, who grew up right here in the city of Bangor, went to high school with John Baps, graduated in the early 90s. So there's a main connection there. And last but not least, I watched on Netflix, The Devil All the Time, which is another incredible cast movie based on a book that by an author who's Donald Ray Pollock, who I really admire. So, where would you like to start, Rich?
Well, gosh. Let's start with the local connection. That sounds good.
Yeah. So it's a movie called Alive. It actually had a screening, not this past weekend, but the weekend before, at the Bangor Drive-In, in connection with Jules Vincent, who is the gentleman who went to high school around here. He was here I think he spoke to the John Baps students at one point. It's a horror movie, I want to put this the right way. It is very much embracing of a B movie sensibility, and I mean that in the most complimentary way possible. Like, I need to be clear on that. Like, I don't. When I say B movie, I'm not talking about like low quality. Like, I'm talking about that sort of pulpy, like splattery, like over the top kind of aesthetic that you got with a lot of the sort of grindhouse, you know, 70s drive-in style movies. Like, it's one of those things where it's like, I regret not getting to see this at the drive-in because it's exactly that kind of movie. So it's a small cast. The majority of the movie is just three actors that really sort of allows for a developing sort of an intimacy that helps develop the impact of the, let's be very clear, incredibly gruesome things that happen over the course of this movie. So the basic gist, we have a man, we never get his name, played by Thomas Cockrell. He wakes up, doesn't know where he is, doesn't know who he is. He's covered in blood, he's badly hurt, and he's unable to speak. He knows nothing about anything, and it only gets worse when a mysterious man clad in scrubs, played by Angus McFadden, appears. He's ostensibly there to care for our patient, but definitely has something sinister and kind of cruel about him, administers some sort of unknown drug treatment, and leaves the guy to fade out of consciousness. When he wakes up, there's a woman in a bed next to him. She also has no idea where they are or who she is, but she's at least able to speak and in slightly better shape, and so they're able to sort of communicate with one another. Now, this doctor claims to be the only person who can help them, even as he totally avoids answering any of their questions about who they are or where they are. It's a wildly unconventional treatment, like homegrown medicines and like physical air quotes therapy that borders on the abusive. He's clearly unstable and with a hair trigger temper. So they're left to this man and woman are left to realize that, like, we have to get out of here. We have to do anything we can to get out. And so they escape from their sort of bonds and realize that they're basically trapped in what is essentially an abandoned hospital or sanitarium. And as they make their way through this place, they start to learn a little bit more about their situation, and none of it is good. Like, none of it is something is stuff like the big thing is they kind of realize that they're far from the first people to sort of have to deal with the healing process that's being put forth by their captor. Like, every door they open, every hallway they walk down, like, there's another horror awaiting for them. And all they have is one another, and the occasional sort of snatch of memory that they pull out that is sort of vague and they don't really understand what's happening. And so their only goal is to escape the clutches of this madman and find their way back to their lives. Now, there's a class. It's a classically simple horror movie. Like, it's two people trapped in an abandoned hospital. Like, that's old school. You know, I mean, there's a literal mad scientist. Like, it's so good. You know, and again, like the sort of splatterhouse vibe is one of the most fun things about this movie. Like, it's so over the top, but it's never haphazard. Like, it's all in service to setting the scene, and it's always kind of trying to outdo itself. And boy, does it ever. Like, no spoilers, but I must be clear. There is a lot of viscera thrown around in this movie. Like, there's a lot of stuff just flying everywhere. And, I mean, the movie is gleeful about it, like, really leaning into the goriness. And we get some very unsettling, undeniably memorable, but very unsettling moments. It takes a couple of really big swings, both in terms of the visual and in terms of the narrative, particularly an ending that I'm not going to spoil. Because it's pretty solid. They have a couple of pretty solid twists that I would hate to for someone to go in knowing, because I think not knowing makes this a lot more fun. Performances are great. Angus McFadden, he's best known. He was Robert the Bruce in Braveheart.
Okay.
And he is just full on, like, honey baked in this film. Like, I mean, he is hamming it in the way that only London trained actors of a certain generation can ham it up. And it's perfect. Like, he's on tilt, like, he's like past max capacity. He's shouting and he's screaming, murmuring and muttering, and it's all mixed together with this wild abandon, and it's just perfect. Like, it's exactly what you want from the bad guy in a movie like this. The other two, they're fine. Like, I mean, they're basic point is to be sort of an audience surrogate, like a cipher almost, for us to project ourselves into their situation, and it works. Again, it all revolves around Angus McFadden just going full on eye bulging lunatic, and it's a lot of fun. Like, it's fun to watch a movie so clearly committed to being what it wants to be. Like, it's precisely what you expect, but still manages to have a trick or two up its sleeve. It's gross and gory, but it's a good time. And again, it's a tight 91 minutes. Like, you certainly you get enough from it to forgive any flaws that the movie might have.
All right, that's the story on Alive. I just, because I saw the trailer last night, let's talk about Antebellum and what you thought of that.
So Antebellum, it's interesting that you saw the trailer, because we saw the trailer too, and it's both appropriate and kind of deceptive, the trailer. For reasons that I've been struggling, like, I struggled to write this review, because it's difficult to really understand, like, where certain people are coming from when they sit down to watch this movie. Like, how much you know about this movie going in makes a very big difference as to how you're going to experience it. The one thing that I think is worth noting, you know, we've talked about this a number of times over the years. You know, genre filmmaking is a wonderful tool in terms of social commentary. Like, the trappings of, like, horror or sci-fi or whatever, they really do give cover for filmmakers to deliver messaging that could potentially be met with resistance in other areas of expression. You know, and so the extrapolation or exaggeration of typical social mores can really say a lot about the world. And this movie definitely tries to do that. Like, it's definitely trying to say something. Although I would argue that, well, whether or not it's ultimately successful, I think is debatable. It's written and directed by a first-time feature filmmaking duo, Gerard Bush and Christopher Renz are the names. They're notable music video directors. Like, they have a history in that arena, but this is their first feature. What they're trying to do is basically bring together the sort of past and present of racism and white supremacist ideas in service of a horror story. And it's like, I should never say never, because, like, Jordan Peele has done it. But the truth is, using real life horrors like that as the basis for fictional ones requires a real delicacy and sophistication that I don't think this movie quite musters. Now, again, it's a well-made movie, and the performances are really good, but it doesn't really deliver on those underlying ideas. And kind of reads like it's using historical atrocities as horror fodder, which is not great. Like, I mean, it just feels content to stay on the surface of the overt rather than really diving into the ideological depth. And I think that results in a movie that feels more exploitative than it actually is. And it's obviously not the intent, but it does ring a little bit wrong. The plot, I'll try to gloss over it. So we meet, we open on a plantation, an Old South plantation during the Civil War. It's in Louisiana and has been commandeered by Confederate forces and being used as a base of operations. We meet a slave named Eden, and that's Janelle Monáe. And her master is sort of the leader of these forces, but we never get his name. He's only referred to as him. He's brutally punishing in the way that he deals with her. But right from the beginning, you get the sense that there's something off. Like, there are these little glimpses and moments that seem incongruous and ill-fitted to this particular time and place. And that sense is exacerbated when a group of new slaves are brought to the plantation, and one of the newcomers, this woman named Julia, played by Kiersey Clemons, recognizes Eden and asks for help in escaping, and seems to indicate that it's something that Eden will be able to do more easily than anybody else. She's too scared and basically shunts off Julia's request. Later, there's a particularly ugly encounter with him, and Eden goes to sleep and dreams of a different life. Or she remembers a different life. Now, in this other life, her name is Veronica Henley, and it's the 21st century. She's a noted sociologist and author. She's got a husband and a daughter, and she's this in-demand sort of academic. She goes to conferences and gives presentations, and in the course of doing that, she goes to one, she meets up with her friends, one of whom is named Dawn and played by the always wonderful Gabourey Sidibe. They hang out, they go out to dinner, they're going to catch up. She decides to head home early, and then the worlds collide in a way that I'm not going to spell out because I feel like it's important for people to experience it in real time. But I can say that basically we find ourselves trapped in a place. She finds herself trapped in a place she doesn't understand, bound by customs that she thought were dead. And she has to find a way to break free from this bondage. And in opposition are a group of vile and hateful people who are determined to maintain their hold on this version of the peculiar institution. And they're willing to kill to do it. Now, again, like I said, there are aspects of this movie that just can't be discussed without spoilers. Though I will say, while watching, you probably won't have much of a problem working out the various narrative twists. But I will say there's a framework of a very good story here. Like, it's a conceit with a lot of potential that has room for that sort of horror red meat while also saying something of social value. But it just doesn't really get fully realized. Like, I think the messaging gets lost in the medium a little bit. In the process of capturing that sort of base unpleasantness and evil that's born of racial inequality, the filmmakers kind of wind up losing the meaning, the deeper meaning. Ultimately, that means that the sort of lurid and ugly stuff kind of feels a little gratuitous, which undermines the impact of what, again, is a pretty good idea. And that's another thing that really should be noted. Like, it gets brutal in ways that I think some viewers will find triggering, off-putting, to the extreme. They really push things right to the edge, and I would argue maybe past it a time or two. And that degree of extremity would be more easily forgiven if the message was being more effectively conveyed. But it almost, and there are a couple of places where it almost feels voyeuristic in a way that doesn't sit well. But again, well made. The filmmakers clearly know their way around a camera and display an obvious understanding of eliciting reactions via imagery. But there's an empty space where that messaging should be. Like, so it's basically, we have an attractive package that doesn't really have anything inside it. Monet's great. I was skeptical when I first heard about her venturing into acting at the beginning of her career. But I will freely admit that I was wrong about that. She's legitimately talented, and she's very good here, like, doing everything she can to elevate this movie. And she's what holds it together as well as it does hold together. You know, I think the cast is, they're all going for it in a way that is admirable, even though I feel like ultimately they're kind of let down by the filmmakers. The good performances, they're just not enough, because the pieces are here for a movie that really works, but it's missing the most important one.
All right, let's go to, we've got about 5 minutes left. Let's hear about The Devil All the Time.
Okay, so, yeah, it's 5 minutes. Oh, man, I tell you what. It's, this movie, it's based on a novel by Donald Ray Pollock from 2011, the same name. It's directed by Antonio Campos from a screenplay he co-wrote with his brother, Paulo. Now, Pollock is known for having a real knack for evoking the dark side of relationships. Like, because, you know, the relationships that exist between people and the motivations that drive those relationships are often the best fodder for storytelling. Like, the reasons we do what we do and the people for whom we do them, like, it in a lot of ways is the purest distillation of our character. And Pollock is really good at showing us how terribly, terribly wrong that can go. Like, books are just packed with the brutality and evil that people do. And they're people who are rendered all the more terrifying by the fact that they sincerely believe that they are justified in what they are doing. And that sense of physical and emotional violence is omnipresent in this movie. It's set in mid-century America, West Virginia and Ohio, and it follows this sprawling collection of different characters through a number of different narratives who their connections, they're all interconnected. Some of those connections are overt, some are much more subtle, and they're in this constant sort of ebb and flow, like moving towards and away from one another, occasionally crossing and then departing. And it's just this incredible, just collection of various sort of narratives. Like, ultimately, it's a story of sin. Like, it's a story of evil, and especially the evil that the pious are capable of if they can convince themselves of their own righteousness. Like, which makes it a striking representation of that particular time and place. Like, this sort of cold country noir kind of thing, like a hillbilly gothic, where it's like, you know, these people are all so single-mindedly devoted to what they believe to be true that they're willing to hurt others in the service of that perceived truth. So it's this unrelenting representation of the dark side of human nature, just a parade of terrible people doing terrible things for terrible reasons. And Rich, it is a lot. It is a lot to watch this movie. Like, it's this bleakly entangled constancy of sex and violence and power and religion, and it borders on the exhausting. Although I will say the combination of excellent performances and quality filmmaking make it worth the undertaking, because I cannot stress enough how stacked this cast is. Like, it's an incredible, incredible group of actors. I'm going to try to do a quick sort of summary of the assorted storylines. And when I name these actors, you're going to understand what I'm talking about. So we first meet Willard Rustle, played by Bill Skarsgård. We first meet him overseas during World War II. He's fighting in the Solomon Islands, where he sees something that haunts him for the rest of his days. He gets home. He decides he wants to settle down and start a family. He actually meets his future wife, Charlotte, played by Haley Bennett, when she's his waitress at a diner in the small town of Meade, Ohio, which is the closest bus stop to Coal Creek, West Virginia, which is his hometown. He goes home. He can't stop thinking about her, so he eventually returns to Meade, and they court. They wind up married. They have a son, and they move into a small isolated house in the tiny Ohio town of the incredible name of Knockemstiff. It's Knockemstiff, Ohio. Just so good. At that roughly around that same time, We also meet a photographer named Carl Henderson, played by Jason Clark, who is in the process of meeting his own future wife, a woman named Sandy, played by Riley Keough, who also works at that diner. Their relationship ultimately takes a dark turn to the point where, look, they might become serial killers. I'm just saying, like that's the kind of movie that we're talking about. And again, like this is all stuff we learn as we meet them because we have a narrator of this movie. The narrator, in just a magnificent meta touch, is actually the novelist Donald Ray Pollock.
Oh, wow.
Narrates the movie, which is such a smart move. Okay, so then we have a religious young lady who lost her family in a fire when she was young, named Helen Hatton, played by Mia Wasikowska, who winds up getting sort of captivated during a church service by a very intense, very strange, charismatic evangelical preacher by the name of Roy Lafferty, played by Harry Melling. He's a full-on, like, I believe in the power of faith to heal kind of guy. And that's a belief that, again, further down the road, is going to result in tragedy. In fact, tragedy and faith are through all these stories. Willard's wife is diagnosed with cancer, and his anger and fear is such, he commits some horrifying acts, which ultimately lead to their son Arvin being sent to live with Willard's mother, who raises him alongside another abandoned child left behind by parents who inexplicably disappeared. We move forward a few years into the mid-60s. We meet a now-grown Arvin, played by Tom Holland, who's deciding what direction his life's going to go. He's very protective of his sister, Lenora, played by Eliza Scanlon, who was so good in Little Women, who's a quiet and awkward girl. Her life is the church. But, as we've already seen, the church can be a place of pain. And when the new preacher, Preston Teagarden, played by an excellent Robert Pattinson, proves to be something of a hypocrite when it comes to following God's path, and that hypocrisy ultimately proves devastating to the life of young Lenora. Again, the connections between these people vary. Some are very firm, some are tenuous, but they're constant. Like, each of them are connected to all the others, usually by tragedy, betrayal, pain, like all these negative connections. And so many of them are blinded by their own wants and desires that they just they see and understand only what they choose to see and understand. And those sorts of blinders unfailingly lead to tragedy, though I will note that some of those tragedies take longer to unfold than others.
Well,
so that's the plot. those are the people that you meet. As far as the plot, like, it's, again, like, it's very dark, very brutal. There's a lot of challenging sort of anger and energy. The movie looks great, like with a really really evocative of time and place, which provides a great juxtaposition to the sort of the narrative Heart of Darkness. It's a very harsh and unrepentant look at the damage that can be done to people by the institutions on which they rely, whether that's church or the government or even your family. Like, all of it brought through with brutality and blood. Like, it's a violent and angry movie, but it's so beautifully made, and the performances are just exceptional. Like, everybody is great. It's the best work I've ever seen from Tom Holland. Like, Pattinson is phenomenal. Clark and Keough are wonderful together. Like, I should make a very specific note of this. I don't ordinarily do this, but in this case, I availed myself of the excellent website resource, doesthedogdie.com, before I watched this movie. And I was glad because I was able to skip a particularly troubling scene. And I will say, anyone out there who ever asks themselves that question in their cultural consumption, does the dog die? Go to the website. They will be they're very specific about what you need to do to not experience this.
Okay.
I can't stress enough. If that's something that troubles you to see that sort of
thing. All right. That sounds good. Yeah. We got to wrap up, Alan. Sorry, man. We got to go. We're running way behind.
I told you, man, 5 minutes wasn't enough.
All right, we'll talk. We read about Blackbird in this week's Main Edge, right?
That's right. Yeah, and it's this week, so I'll talk to you on Wednesday.
I look forward to it. Thanks, Al.
Bye, man.